The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you think the God of the Bible is old-fashioned and behind the times. I mean, look at the subject of premarital sex. You ask yourself, why is that wrong? What's the big deal if I sleep with my girlfriend? Well, my friend, God does not issue commands arbitrarily. He has reasons, and when you have heard his reasons, you may be surprised. You may even find yourself agreeing with God. Stranger things have happened. We began a discussion of premarital sex during the final few minutes of last week's program. Today, we will continue with that stimulating subject. No pun intended. Well, I guess the pun was kind of intended, but first, some news commentary, as if there haven't been enough shooting sprees in the news lately. Another gunman joins the venomous Nutjob Hall of Fame. This time, the intended target was a local chapter of Family Research Council in downtown New York. Fortunately, the perpetrator was stopped and literally wrestled to the ground by a gutsy security guard who ended up taking a bullet himself while saving the lives of many intended victims. Mr. Johnson, the security guard, has survived the gun wound. That's the good news. The gunman was identified as Floyd L. Corkins the second. I'll bet he makes Floyd L. Corkins the first awfully proud. 28 years old. Isn't that nice? He was held on a charge of assault with a deadly weapon in what the FBI has called an act of domestic terrorism. A law enforcement official said Corkins told Johnson, "I don't like your politics." Well, what were those politics? Well, the politics was, things like they believe in the biblical definition of marriage, emotionally charged things like that. Mr. Corkins had been a volunteer at the D.C. Center, a lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community. David Mariner, the center's executive director, gave out that information. And according to the New York Times, Mariner was a signatory to a letter that gay and lesbian rights groups released immediately after the shooting. And it stated, "We utterly reject and condemn such violence." And by late Wednesday, more than 40 organizations had signed on. Fox News adds an interesting wrinkle. The suspect told the security guard, "Don't shoot me. It was not about you. It was what this place stands for." Now, the story has gotten very little play from our mainstream media, but that's to be understood. Their responsibility is to emphasize important news, such as Mitt Romney's tax returns. On the day of the shooting, ABC's World News did mention the incident briefly, keying in mostly on the brave security guard. On the other hand, PBS NewsHour was quiet as Harpo Marx. MSNBC's Chris Matthews was also silent. Who would have thought Matthews could keep his mouth shut about anything? Rachel Maddow said a little, but very little. So did Brian Williams. And according to Newsbusters, on Thursday morning, the network pattern continued. ABC offered another full story, adding the LGBT volunteer connection. By contrast, NBC offered a tiny Anchorman update. CBS aired nothing, but did find the time for the story of the 40th anniversary of the movie Deliverance. But as most networks only go home with consolation prizes, such as lovely luggage or beautiful rotisserie, CNN wins the grand prize, chosen especially for them. The program Early Start on CNN interviewed Brian Brown of the National Organization for Marriage. Now, it seems Brown complained on that program about an organization called Southern Poverty Law Center This organization labels different conservative groups as hate groups. And they certainly had a label for FRC and tried to show this man, then Brown, tried to show a connection between that kind of rhetoric and the shooting. CNN anchor Zoraida Zambolin countered by insisting that Family Resource Council deserved its hate group designation. As evidence, she offered a 1999 FRC pamphlet on the National Man-Boy-Lover Association and its relationship to gay activists. She said, well, that's spewing hate, isn't it? So it's hate spewing hate. Okay, now think about this. Okay, I understand that the gay community is in uproar when anybody mentions the connection between them and the National Man-Boy-Lover Association, a political group of pedophiles. I understand that they don't like that, but is mentioning that they have an association with gay activists hate? Everybody's asking whether it's hate. Nobody's asking whether it's true. Nobody's asking whether it's factual. It is a fact that people from NAMBLA have marched in gay pride parades. Now, that doesn't mean all gay people are pedophiles. I'm not even talking about any certain percentage of gay people being pedophiles. I'm just saying, but to merely speak the truth, they do march in the parade. So relax out there. Stop. Take a deep breath. Compose yourself. Nobody is claiming, I'm certainly not claiming that gay people are pedophiles, but it is a fact. If NAMBLA marches in gay pride parades, they march in gay pride parades. What are we supposed to do? Lie and say it didn't happen? Now, if I were going to make an observation about that, here's the observation, and you have to listen to this carefully. NAMBLA is trying to lobby for its rights. They want to see the day come where it's not illegal to be a pedophile. And what they're doing, what they are doing, where there is a connection, is they, and it's their responsibility, not the gay community's responsibility, but they are emulating gay activists. We're going to start seeing the same rhetoric from them. Oh, you think it's wrong for an adult to have sex with a child? What are you, a pedophilophobe? What are you, filled with hate speech? See, if it worked before, they're thinking, well, maybe it will work with us. That's the connection. They're saying, okay, if we've established that there's nothing unnatural about having sex with your own gender, then what's unnatural about having sex with a child? There's college professors today and many people in Europe that are starting to say that. So is raising concern about that connection hate, or is it just making an observation about where we may end up as a society historically? Anyway, this was what the CNN anchor Zambolin brought up. So she was, she didn't come out and say it in so many words, but she wasn't showing a whole lot of sympathy. And she was basically saying that the Family Research Council is a hate group. And Zambolin, folks, offers us the ultimate lesson. As far as news is concerned, conservatives don't make good victims. Conservatives only make good assassins. Such is the response of our mainstream media to an evil shooting that might have been a massacre if not for one heroic security guard. True, our news empires have covered other shootings, some very recent, and they've covered them with greater zeal. But in those cases, you need to understand there was least a sporting chance of linking the gunslinger with conservatives. The LA Times, for example, swiftly identified Sikh temple gunman Wade Michael Page as a right-wing extremist. In fact, he was a member of two racist skinhead groups, End Apathy and Definite Hate. Since the media is just as quick to label the Tea Party, evangelical Christians, or conservatives in general as extreme right-wing, the implication is not exactly a subtle one. On the other hand, don't expect to see a lot of media pundits talk about the extreme left-wing politics of Floyd L. Corkins II. After all, today's journalism doesn't believe in an extreme left-wing. You'd think you'd have to have two wings to fly, but they don't see it that way. You see, there's the right wing on one side. The other side, it's not really a wing at all. It's just made up of moderate, sophisticated common sense, which any thinking person will embrace. Meanwhile, in cases where a gunman doesn't have even a fringe right group on his resume, people like ABC News reporter Brian Ross still plow ahead by quickly reporting that a certain James Holmes, a same name as the Colorado movie theater shooter, was a member of the Colorado Tea Party. Although saying up front that they had not yet established this individual as the same James Holmes, and admitting later on that the Tea Party member was indeed a different man, Ross still entered the Tea Party casually into our discussion of violence like a post-hypnotic suggestion. And who can forget New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, who wrote regarding last year's Arizona shooting, which killed several people and wounded Congresswoman Gabriella Giffords. He said, "It is facile and mistaken to attribute this particular madman's act directly to Republicans or Tea Party members." Okay, so far so good. Although something about the way he said don't relate to the Tea Party directly makes me think he's going to try to do it indirectly, which is just exactly what he does. Then he goes on, he says, but it is legitimate to hold Republicans and particularly their most virulent supporters in the media responsible for the gale of anger that has produced the vast majority of these threats, setting the nation on edge. Translation, even though we should not blame the Tea Party or the Republicans, I'm about to do so anyway. Of course, there was no evidence that the Arizona tragedy had anything to do with Tea Parties or Republicans. In fact, it turned out that Jared Lee Loeffner was a registered independent who did not even vote in the 2010 election. He also owned a copy of the Communist Manifesto. Now, I doubt that Republicans or Tea Party members used the writings of Marx as Christmas morning stocking stuffers. Don't hold your breath waiting to hear Paul Krugman write a sequel editorial suggesting that groups like Human Rights Campaign or Southern Poverty Law Center are responsible for a gale of anger that produces the vast majority of threats, even though both organizations have labeled Family Research Council a hate group. Not that we would want Krugman or anyone else to connect such dots. In point of fact, HRC and SPLC are not responsible. Neither are the other gay activists who loosely toss around the word hate when describing those who believe in traditional marriage. At the risk of making an outrageous understatement, the guy responsible for a gunshot is the guy who shoots off the gun. Corkins alone is responsible. But so was Loeffner with the Arizona shooting. Why is the origin of blame so clear in one case and not with another? In response to Family Research Council President Tony Perkins' assertion that Floyd Corkins was, in his words, given a license to shoot an unarmed man by organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Law Center released its own statement, and oh, the media does like this statement, so they'll freely distribute this. Here's what it says. Perkins' accusation is outrageous. The SPLC has listed the FRC as a hate group since 2010 because it has knowingly spread false and denigrating propaganda about LGBT people, not as some claim because it opposes same-sex marriage. The FRC and its allies on the religious right are saying, in effect, that offering legitimate and fact-based criticism in a democratic society is tantamount to suggesting that the objects of criticism should be the targets of criminal violence. More on this shooting when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life, but Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170, 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. Okay, the Southern Poverty Law Center had labeled the Family Research Council as a hate group. And so the president of the Family Research Council said, well, maybe this gave license to the man who went and tried to shoot us. And the Southern Poverty Law Center responded. I read their statement before we went to the break. And they said, let me read the end of it again. The FRC and its allies on the religious right are saying, in effect, that offering legitimate and fact-based criticism in a democratic society is tantamount to suggesting that the objects of criticism should be the targets of criminal violence. In other words, they're saying this was not their fault. Now, I agree with them. I'm not going to switch sides just when it's convenient. We need to be consistent, whether we're conservative or liberal. And yet, I do want to point out, concern over violence inspired by hateful teaching is the heart and soul of SPLC's very existence. It all depends on how one defines hate, I guess. Many who reject same-sex marriage would deny being motivated by hate and would instead offer what they consider to be a legitimate, in fact, based criticism in a democratic society. They would also ask if calling Christians hateful is itself a hateful practice. It would certainly be refreshing for our country to hold a calm, friendly, sensible debate on the issue of same-sex marriage or any of the other electrically charged issues. Such discussions will be fruitless unless all colorful adjectives are left at the door. It would probably be too docile a meeting for network news. Meanwhile, I call upon both sides to be consistent. Conservatives cannot blame Human Rights Campaign or Southern Poverty Law Center for the most recent shooting. Neither should the entire Tea Party be blamed for violence, should the day ever come when a Tea Party member actually does commit some violence instead of the mainstream media having to make it up. Well, if you'd like to weigh in on any of this, call in toll-free number 888-344-1170. You can also reach me on the internet, questions@bobsiegel.net, questions@bobsiegel, SIEGEL.net, or through Facebook or Twitter. And as usual, the monologue that I shared today also had a Washington Times Communities version. Deb on Facebook is responding to that specifically. She says, I very much enjoyed the well-written article. Thank you so much for your candid, truthful, and straightforward style. I wish there were more men like you with clear vision, an opinion I maintain even when we disagree, which isn't often. Disagree? Deb, did I hear the word disagree? Now, Deb, who could ever disagree with their old pal, Bob? Thanks, Deb. Actually, that was a very encouraging comment. This next guy, again, a lot of people use weird names on the internet. If I made some of these comments, I'd change my name too. Proto Guy is trying to get at the angle of why I wrote that piece, because I'm making the whole point in my article that the mainstream media is kind of ignoring this, because this time it's the conservative who are the victims. So he says, is it so rare that you have to point it out, or is it so choice a political football that you couldn't help punting it? Well, thank you for asking, Proto Guy. I'm sure that was a very sincere question. So here's my sincere answer. My motive for talking about this couldn't possibly have been made more clear. Hypocrisy bothers me, especially the hypocrisy of our mainstream media, which only emphasizes the news that fits their agenda. Did I answer your question, Proto Guy? This one's from Marco. He says, well, what does FRC expect? They have been crying wolf for years and people are sick and tired of them. Family Research Council should take a hint. Oh, very thoughtful comment, Marco. Very thoughtful. Yeah, I just love it. People are tired of hearing a viewpoint they don't like. So back down, FRC, or somebody may come and shoot you. Marco, you are disgraceful. An absolute disgrace to the freedoms of our country. This guy calls himself Hail to the Chef. Not Hail to the Chief. Hail to the Chef. He says, no one was killed. You need more carnage for it to count as a big news entertainment story at this point. Oh, I see. Yeah, it just wasn't newsworthy. That explains it. Really now, if the shooting had taken place in an abortion clinic or the offices of Human Rights Campaign, this would be the leading story, the headline with the mainstream media for literally weeks, if not months, whether the shooting killed anyone or not. This person calls herself What's My Party. She says, if the SPLC created an environment that encouraged Corkins to resort to violence an environment that encourages over 1,000 anti-gay violent hate crimes, including dozens of murders each year. I guess she didn't finish the comment, but I guess she's saying if they created that climate, then that's the climate. So in other words, why worry so much about this one? This has been going on for years on the other side. I love this two wrongs make a right. Anyway, this comment is pure poppycock. Most people who object to same-sex marriage do not hate homosexuals. Neither do they encourage violence. Are there people who hate gays? Sadly, yes. But many different kinds of people are hated for many different kinds of reasons. In any event, I was not making the case that anyone was responsible for this shooting other than the shooter. So the discussion of who inspired what is irrelevant. This person calls himself Chev. He says, I sat down for dinner in a restaurant only to find myself robbed and then accosted by some people screaming all manner of anti-gay hate at me. And then one of them took a wine glass, smashed it on the side of my head, and dragged it across my face. My whole life I have heard of gay friends getting attacked and even killed for being gay, and it never made national news. Now a single incident of gay on straight violence and the right is in an uproar. Pathetic. Well, I'm sorry that happened to you, my friend. It was horrible. It was inexcusable and evil. But it is not the fault of people who merely disagree with your lifestyle, many of them having personal gay friends whom they treat with love and respect. And my uproar, again, is aimed at the shooter alone, along with our inconsistent media. I cannot emphasize this point enough. Sherry says, the FRC has been labeled a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. What liberals are increasingly showing is that, in their minds, committing any crime against social conservatives in order to pursue their homosexuality agenda is considered just. Such attitudes are fueled by relentless rhetoric against social conservatives, which vilifies the latter as the haters and the evil people in society. In short, if you question the liberal homosexuality agenda, you are a hater. And if you are a hater, violence, discrimination, and unethical acts against you are justified. Well, I think there are some people that view it that way. Fortunately, there are a lot of people who do not. Well, we're going to return to the question we started at the beginning of the program and ended up with on last week's program. Why is premarital sex a sin? Now, last week, as I began developing this, I pointed out that technically, if we wanted to get real technical, in the New Testament, Jesus said all the laws, or at least there were ritual laws in the Old Testament, but all the moral laws really fall under one category. It's really only one law. Love your neighbor as yourself, or as you would have people treat you, treat them. It's described in both ways in the scriptures, in Galatians, and in Matthew chapter 7, verse 12, very specifically, where Jesus said, it's what we commonly call the golden rule. If I really love my neighbor, I will not steal from him. If I really love my neighbor, I will not sleep around with his wife. And of course, I will not kill him. So when we want to know why something is a sin, we have to ask ourselves how it violates this rule. Violating the golden rule is what makes something a sin. So if we're going to ask whether premarital sex is a sin, then the question would be, is premarital sex selfish? Is premarital sex something where I'm not treating this person the way I want to be treated? We'll answer that when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539. W&S Electric.
Hey.
Welcome back to KCBQ. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. Jesus said, as you would have people treat you, treat them. That's the summary of God's law. Sin is the breaking of God's law. So when the Bible says we're morally sinning, it means we're not treating somebody the way we would want to be treated. Now, I'm going to tell you, you're not going to find anybody who's going to disagree with that, except maybe Friedrich Nietzsche, and he's dead. But when I debate atheists, they like to get up right away and they go, hey, just because we're atheists doesn't mean we don't have moral standards, doesn't mean we don't believe in the golden rule. Okay, I agree with them. Because God created us that way. God gave us all a conscience, Christian, atheist, or otherwise. So you're thinking, well, yes, Bob, but those are obvious examples. If I love my neighbor, I won't steal from him. If I love my neighbor, I won't commit adultery. If I love my neighbor, I won't kill. I see how it fulfills some of those Ten Commandments. But that other commandment in the New Testament about premarital sex, that's condemned also. And that doesn't have anything to do with selfishness. Okay, well, the relationship between biblically labeled taboos and selfishness is not always immediately apparent. But if we can find the connection, we can agree with God's appraisal of the action. With this in mind, we are now ready to look at the issue of premarital sex. A student once approached me at my book table at the University of California in San Diego, claiming the Bible was outdated. He mentioned the listing of certain sexual sins as an example. Certainly, he could see the betrayal and dishonesty associated with adultery, but sex outside of marriage was another story. He acknowledged that the Bible labeled premarital sex as a sin, but expressed bewilderment as to why it was a sin. Now, after I asked him if he at least agreed with Jesus' golden rule, he quickly said, yes, of course. I said, okay, so we would both agree that we should treat others the way we want to be treated. He says, sure, but that has nothing to do with sex. But, well, supposing I could show you that it did. Well, I doubt that you could. And then he went on, tell me, what's wrong with having sex with my girlfriend as long as I love her? Now, you Christians in the audience, you're going to be very surprised at my answer. But keep listening. Don't shut your radio off. Let's not have any accidents on the freeway. He says, what's wrong with having sex with my girlfriend as long as I love her? I said, nothing. Okay, the student almost fell over with astonishment. What? Nothing. I repeated it. Nothing. Nothing? Nope. If you love her, as you say, nothing is wrong with having sex. Oh, it was clear that he was unprepared for this answer. He had obviously expected me to quote some Bible verses that slam premarital sex. Oh, I must admit, you're a lot more open-minded than most of the Christians. I mean, I said, well, I'm not done yet. And then his cheery disposition melted as he awaited an explanation that would surely show the fine print. And I continued. When you say you love your girlfriend, what do you mean? Huh? What do you mean exactly when you say you love your girlfriend? We're both agreeing right now to a certain standard here that sex belongs in the context of love. That's fine. But how are you defining love? Well, I don't know. I love her. That's all. Okay, well, is this love just a feeling or does it include a commitment? Well, I'm committed to her. Okay, well, for how long? Are you committed for life? Do you love her unconditionally? Or do you only love her until someone more attractive comes along? Or until you grow tired of her? Or until she displays some weakness that you don't want to live with? Are you willing to someday leave her, this woman with whom you became so intimate? This person who made herself so vulnerable to you that she expressed her sexuality? Could you someday desert her and devastate her by breaking her heart? In only a few short moments, this poor student realized that he didn't love his girlfriend nearly as much as he thought he did. But isn't it interesting to see that even without a Bible, he did have some standards in relation to sexuality? Sex apart from love was wrong. This he could understand. This he could relate to. Folks, God is not some celestial killjoy who gets upset when we're having a good time. God is not anti-sex. God invented sex. A whole book in the Bible, Song of Solomon, is nothing but a sensuous love sonnet between a man and a woman. But a lot of Christians don't even realize that. You know why? Because when pastors preach from Song of Solomon, actually, they usually don't preach from Song of Solomon, but when they do, they go, oh, well, this is all allegorical. This is all about Jesus Christ's love for the church. Jesus Christ is the groom. The church is the bride. Okay, that sounds great. That's not what Solomon was talking about. He was talking about having sex with his wife, with one of his wives, I should say. That's another whole can of worms. They did have plural marriage in those days. We'll have to discuss that another time. But it was a sensuous love sonnet, certainly a demonstration that God was not anti-sex. In fact, the rabbis, when they held the Council of Jamnia in 100 AD, after the destruction of the Jerusalem temple that had been down for several decades, this book had made it into their canon, but they were kind of it had made it into the collection, but this council was going to officially canonize it. And it almost didn't make the cut. And what's interesting is if those same Jews had been arguing about the book 100 years prior, it would have made the cut with ease, because Judaism originally didn't have a hang-up about sex. Oh, it did teach sex within marriage. Absolutely. Absolutely, sex within marriage. But they didn't think sex was something wrong or evil or dirty. That idea came from Greece. Some of the Greek philosophies taught that anything physical or material, anything pleasurable, was evil, and only the immaterial spirit inside was pure. And Judaism at this time in history had come over under the influence of Greece. Alexander the Great had conquered a lot of the Western world. The Jews lived under Greeks for quite some time. Even when the Romans threw the Greeks out and took over the party, Greek was the language of the marketplace. Greek was the language of the courts. Many Jews, in addition to speaking Hebrew or Aramaic, spoke Greek. That's why the New Testament, which is written almost entirely by Jews, the only exception being Luke, they were written in Greek. So now the rabbis under Greek influence they're thinking, wow, something like sex, we can't put that in the Bible. What does that have to do with God? But you got to understand, folks, 100 years before, the rabbis would not have asked that question. But another idea had developed by the Greeks, and that was the allegorical method of interpreting things. So one of the rabbis said, hey, I know, maybe this isn't really about Solomon and his wife. Maybe this is really about God's love for Israel. God's the husband, Israel's the bride. Now, that idea then crept into the church, which grew out of Judaism and was replaced with Christ being the groom and the church being the bride. So that sounds great. That sounds spiritual. It's beautifully allegorical, but that's not what Song of Solomon was about. All to say that God, by putting this sensual love sonnet in his very holy word, is showing us that he considers sex to be a beautiful thing. God invented sex. God is not anti-sex. God does not sit up on his cloud and say, you're having too much fun down there. Okay. Well, then why would God call premarital sex wrong if he hasn't a problem with sex? Because God does care about broken hearts. God is interested in the way we treat people. For these reasons, he speaks against sex outside of marriage. Your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. So I'm talking to this student out of UCSD. He says, what's wrong with sleeping around with my girlfriend as long as I love her? I say, well, nothing, as long as you love her. But then when I ask for his definition of love, I'm asking, is it unconditional? Or are you going to leave this woman when the chips are down? So he says, okay, well, supposing I were to decide never to leave her, I will never break up. Then can we have sex? I said, well, if you're really committed to her for life and she's committed to you for life, then we are talking about marriage. What else is marriage? That's what marriage is. So this would not be sex outside of marriage, but sex within marriage. He goes, yeah, but what if we wanted to be committed without legally marrying? I said, well, what would be your reason for that? Is your relationship with her a secret? Are there certain people whom you don't want to know about it? If you can't be open about your commitment to her, it isn't really a commitment. Other women will still feel free to flirt with you. Men will flirt with her. He goes, okay, boy, this guy was determined. He says, well, we don't have to make it a secret. We'll be public about it. But why is the marriage license so important? Isn't the main thing that we're committed before people and before God? Why is a piece of paper such a big deal? And I said, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. The piece of paper isn't a big deal. The main thing is being committed before people and before God. So since you have done that, and since the marriage license isn't a big deal anyway, why not just go ahead and get a marriage license? You're not going to have a problem with it, are you? After all, it's only putting on paper the reality of your situation. You just said the paper's not a big deal. Oh, I wish you could have been there to see the look on his face. Obviously, one who is not ready for a marriage license is one who has not truly made a marriage commitment. Now, maybe I want to be fair here. I'm a reasonable guy. Maybe if some couple were stranded on a desert island but committed to each other, they could have sexual relations provided they truly take a vow on the island before God, promising God that if they ever get rescued, they will obtain a marriage license immediately. But of course, this UCSD student didn't fall into such a category. He came to realize that we weren't making wedding rings, pieces of paper, or even Bible verses into something sacred in their own right. Instead, we were discussing a God who looks at our hearts and motives and gives us this one command: as you would have people treat you, treat them. Another student once asked me a similar question, but he left out words such as love and commitment. He found them unnecessary. He says, what's wrong with sleeping around with women? I'm not hurting anybody. And maybe our sexual relations are casual. Maybe they're not related with love in this case. Maybe these women won't mind me leaving them eventually or having a one-night stand. So again, what harm is being done? It's what they call hooking up these days. Now notice how he did agree that sex would be wrong if harm were being done. Isn't it interesting how our Freudian slips reveal these things? He goes out of his way to say, oh, it's not causing any harm. Okay, so by saying that, he's admitting that if it did cause harm, it would be wrong. It's just that he didn't see the harm. Of course, he did find it necessary to make some immediate qualifications, because I asked him some question. I said, do you have any sexual standards at all? He says, well, yeah, if venereal diseases were transmitted, certainly that would be harm. I got a woman pregnant, certainly that would say something about the need to associate sex with commitment. But my cheery friend was quite confident that he could have free, safe sex without incurring such adults. So he says, tell me then, what is wrong with premarital sex? I said, well, nothing is wrong with the experience itself. God isn't upset that you enjoy women, but these women may someday be married to husbands who would object to what you did. Can you relate to these men? Let me ask you a question. Supposing the shoe was on the other foot, supposing you had just gotten married and on your honeymoon night, your wife turned to you and said, sweetie, I have a confession to make. I slept around with 50 men before I met you. Then he gave this sly little grin. He goes, well, obviously that would bother me, but come on, I mean, 50 men, isn't that kind of an exaggeration? I said, all right, 40. Feel better now? How about just 10? Okay. Five. He finally admitted to me that he would feel bad even if his wife had only slept with one man. Then he did what I call altering the premise of the argument. He goes, so what are you saying here? Am I not supposed to get married to a woman who has a past? I thought the gospel was about forgiveness. I says, of course it's about forgiveness. And we all have a past. But you weren't asking me about forgiving a violation of the standard. You were simply asking if the standard exists, and it certainly does. We both agree that we should treat others the same way we want to be treated. Sleeping around with women, even women who say they are uninterested in a commitment from you, is unfair to the way their future husbands may feel, for you are not showing those future husbands the respect you would have wanted your wife's previous suitors to show you. Therefore, Jesus' golden rule applies again. Okay, three for three. A third challenge came from the hardest nut to crack. I asked him a similar question. This time I got a completely different answer. I asked him this thing about, you're on your honeymoon, your wife says you slept with 50. He says, honestly, wouldn't bother me at all. I would not care if my wife had slept with 50 men. I would not care if my wife had slept with 100 men before she met me. Now, I wasn't sure I believed him. I wasn't sure if he had ever truly fallen in love and experienced that small emotion called jealousy. Still, I took him at his word and I went on. I said, but whether or not it bothers you, future husbands of the women you sleep around with may be bothered. He says, that's not my problem. I said, yes, it is your problem if you're going to take Jesus' words seriously, as you would have people treat you, treat them. See how it keeps going back to the golden rule? That's my point. You should respect their feelings and they in turn should respect yours, even when you feel differently about things. God did not arbitrarily make up standards out of some desire to make our lives miserable. God wants what is best for us, and if we are made in his image, we in turn must want what is best for those around us. Well, speaking of sex, the Virgin Mary never had to have any before giving birth to Jesus. That's why they call her the Virgin Mary. But there are problems people have with that narrative. Here's a question, Bob. Aren't the genealogies of Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Luke a contradiction? They give different names for Joseph's father, and after that, the rest of the lineage is also listed differently. Okay, now on a first glance, this does seem like a contradiction. Matthew 1:16, reading part of a big genealogy, and Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, who was born Jesus, who was called Christ. And then we read Luke 3:23 and 24. Now, Jesus himself was about 30 years old when he began his ministry. He was the son, so it was thought of Joseph, the son of Heli, the son of Mathat. So we're seeing a different father for Joseph. Heli in one case, Jacob the other. In all probability, Luke is giving us Mary's genealogy rather than Joseph's. Oh, but Bob, it doesn't say that. Luke also calls Jesus the son of Joseph. Well, in ancient Judaism, if a man had no son, his son-in-law was viewed as his son, and this same man received his inheritance. For that reason, Heli might actually be the father of Mary, and it would have been considered just as proper to call him the father of Joseph, especially in a genealogy.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's weekly column for Washington Times Communities. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net, S-I-E-G-E-L, bobsiegel.net. Here, you can download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show, a sanctuary for skeptics and doubters. And one question that I get a lot is the two different genealogies given for Jesus, one in the Gospel of Matthew, one in the Gospel of Mark, where they list different people as the father of Joseph. Heli is called the father of Joseph in this gospel. And I mentioned that Heli was probably Joseph's father-in-law, and Heli was probably the father of Mary, because in that culture, if a man didn't have a son, then his son-in-law would get the inheritance. And they would leave the mother out and list only the son-in-law in the genealogy. That was a common thing. It was a very patriarchal culture. Now, evidence for this plausible theory can be found by turning to the pages of the Jerusalem Talmud, an ancient rabbinical commentary that tends to paint Jesus and his mother Mary with derogatory strokes. But in the Talmud, Mary is actually referred to as the daughter of Heli. Isn't that interesting? But you're wondering, why would God have given us both genealogies? Okay, this excellent question has a fascinating answer. Although not his blood father, Joseph was Jesus' legal father, and Joseph was related to King David. David, of course, had many wives and therefore many children. As a result, not all of his offspring were in the kingly line. But the Messiah had to be both a blood descendant of King David and the legal heir through the kingly line. Now then, Mary was also related to King David, but not through the kingly line. The two genealogies tell us something very interesting about Jesus' credentials. Jesus was a literal blood descendant of King David, not through the kingly line because of his mother Mary, but he was also a legal descendant of David through the kingly line due to his adoptive father, Joseph. All right, now why is all this relevant? Because the last king of Judah, prior to the destruction of the nation at the hands of the Babylonians, was a man named King Jehoiachin. Some translations call him King Jeconiah. Jehoiachin did not walk with God, and as a result, God predicted through the prophet Jeremiah that none of Jehoiachin's descendants would ever sit on the throne of Israel. I'm reading from Jeremiah chapter 22. Is this man Jehoiachin a despised broken pot, an object no one wants? Why will he and his children be hurled out, cast into a land they do not know? Land, 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 hear the word of the Lord. This is what the Lord says. Record this man as if childless, a man who will not prosper in his lifetime, for none of his offspring will prosper. None will sit on the throne of David or rule anymore in Judah. Okay, well, now we have an even bigger paradox. If the Messiah must be related to King David and legal heir through the kingly line, then he must also be related to King Jehoiachin, because he's in the kingly line too. That's why he's called the king. But the Jehoiachin curse prohibits further kings of Israel, for none of Jehoiachin's children or descendants can sit on the throne. The virgin birth solves our paradox. Jesus is a literal blood descendant of King David, but not through the kingly line, through Mary. Therefore, the Jehoiachin curse does not affect him. Still, the Messiah had to be the legal heir to the throne, and Jesus is legally related to David through Joseph. But since it is legal only and not a blood relation, the Jehoiachin curse still does not touch him. Folks, the Bible has been around a long time. Often what seems like a contradiction to us is worked out by a wonderful God who loves to startle and amaze his followers. Messianic prophecy has been fulfilled through the miracle of the virgin birth. That seems to be the reason for the two different genealogies, and that is one of the reasons why the Messiah needed to be born of a virgin. Okay, let's get off these emotional things and get real heady. Bob, I have heard that there are many differences when we read the Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, that many of the monks making copies changed things to promote their own theology or to harmonize one passage with a parallel account. If it is true that certain passages are in some manuscripts and not others, how do we know for sure what truly belongs in the Bible? Okay, it is true that certain passages are not in the oldest texts, but keep in mind that even our oldest texts are not the originals. For this reason, some scholars are more intrigued by what made it into the majority of the manuscripts. Bottom line, these verses are few. If we kept them in or left them out, no material doctrine or teaching or truth from the Bible would be changed. Now, as to why these differences occurred in the first place, let me illustrate by using one example. There's many examples, but I'm going to use one that's very fascinating to me. It's a passage sometimes called the pericope, sometimes called the floating passage. The verses are John 7, 53 through 8, 11. It's that beloved, very popular account, actually, where Jesus rescues the woman caught in adultery from being stoned to death and forgives her and chases off the people trying to stone her. Now, that passage is found in only one unical manuscript, unical meaning manuscripts that were written in Greek with all capital letters. Six omit it completely. Two leave a blank space where it should have been found. As for late Greek and medieval manuscripts, even then it is often marked to show that its genuineness is doubted by some. Now, that shows the integrity of a lot of these monks, since their integrity is being questioned. If they doubted something, they were pretty honest about it. Then the passage is not included in early Syriac, Coptic, or Egyptian versions, and it is left out of some of the early Latin versions. To make matters worse, none of the early apostolic fathers seem to know anything about it. The very first Greek commentator to say anything about it is Zigabanus. Is that a name for you? Zigabanus. And his date is very late. AD 1118. On the other hand, this passage is found in one relatively early unical document called the Codex Basea, and that dates between the 5th and 6th centuries AD. Jerome also knew of this account in the 4th century and included it in the famous Latin Vulgate, the first Latin translation of the Bible. Augustine and Ambrose knew it also, and both men comment on it. The passage is in all the later manuscripts, but its order differs from place to place. In some manuscripts, it's found at the end of John. In other places, it follows Luke 21:38. You can see how it obtained the nickname Floating Passage. The Floating Passage is quoted in a 3rd century book entitled The Apostolic Constitutions, where it is given as a warning to bishops who are too strict. Eusebius, the early church historian, says Papias, who lived not long after 100 AD, so he's very close to the time of the apostles, he tells a story of a woman who was accused of many sins before the Lord. And finally, although none of the early Greek fathers refer to the passage, several early Latin fathers do. How then do we explain this unusual passage? I believe Augustine provides the biggest clue. He says this was removed from the gospel because some were of slight faith and to avoid a scandal. You see, early in church history, the monastic movement spread like wildfire. They were influenced by that same Greek idea I told you about earlier in the program. Anything pleasurable is a sin. So now with this Greek idea, monks are now taking vows of chastity and vows of poverty. It's not even about sex outside of marriage anymore. Monks, they wouldn't say it was a sin to get married, but they'd say if you wanted to be really holy, you don't get married at all. You take a vow of chastity. Now, these same monks were partly responsible for the transmission of the New Testament text. Even though forgiveness is a strong Christian virtue, there was a time when sexual purity was emphasized to the point where people could no longer see the forest for the trees. Some over-enthusiastic monk may have removed this text because it seemed in his mind to be permissive of adultery. In his mind only, as the early text clearly shows Jesus telling the woman, go and sin no more. He still called it a sin. It's just that Jesus treated her with respect. Fortunately, emotional, overly enthusiastic monks were countered by the objective monks who had no agenda other than to transmit faithfully what the text really said. And so in time, this interesting passage got put back in, but by that time, people probably had no certainty as to where it should be placed. Because of its floating order, the passage may not actually belong to John. It does not seem to be written in John's style, as a matter of fact, but wherever it belongs, I'm convinced that this story represents a genuine account of Jesus and does belong in our Bible. Well, from sex to manuscripts to virgins having babies without sex, where else could you hear all this stuff but the Bob Siegel Show? I know, the loony bin, some of you are thinking, but I will see you here over the air next week.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel. Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ.